Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Curtis, chair of the Bay Gourmet Forum of the Commonwealth Club, and I'm really pleased to introduce our speaker, Professor Richard Wrangham. Richard Wrangham is a Ruth Moore Professor of Anthropology and chair of Biological Anthropology at Harvard University. He received a PhD in zoology from Cambridge University, where he studied under the renowned ethologist Robert Hind. He has also served as a faculty member at Bristol University, Stanford, King's College Cambridge, and University of Michigan Ann Arbor. For several decades now, Professor Wrangham has studied primates in the wild, including several species of baboon and vervet monkeys, but his work on the ecological and behavior comparisons of chimpanzees and humans has been his greatest contribution to animal behavior literature. Professor Wrangham's important observations and theoretical contributions to the field of primate social behavior are covered in a variety of works. Leading up to his latest, the groundbreaking Catching Fire, How Cooking Made Us Human. A recent New York Times review states, Catching Fire is a plain-spoken and thoroughly gripping scientific essay that presents nothing less than a new theory about human evolution, one he calls the cooking hypothesis, one that Darwin, amongst others, simply missed. So please help me to welcome Richard Wrangham.
Thank you, Kathy, and thank you very much for taking time out of your busy days to be here. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm not really sure what I'm doing here because I'm a primatologist, and here I am suddenly writing about human evolution. But I'll tell you what it is. It's from studying chimpanzees, and the notion that you are what you eat, the notion that food is central to understanding what kind of species you are, is something that we've had for forever. And the question is, what is it that is really characteristic of our diets? Well, for years, anthropologists have said it's the fact that we eat lots of meat. And it's true. Meat eating is very important for humans. But when you study chimpanzees, the notion that is represented in this picture is a bit startling. Here we have a Photoshop fantasy. Chimpanzees do not actually make kebabs in the wild. What they are doing here is they're putting stems into an ant nest and allowing the ants to crawl up, and then they're going to eat the ants off the stems. It is a shocking concept that another species could cook. Cooking is the signature feature of the human diet and not of any other species. And it was this sort of slowly dawned on me. I mean, for me, this began with long days of watching chimpanzees in the wild, getting up at dawn, watching them get out of their bed nests, following them all day until the evening, and sometimes not taking any food with me and saying, okay, well, we're very close to related to chimpanzees, so I'll just eat chimpanzee food. Well, it's pretty disgusting. There is Hugo eating a fig in the top left, and the typical kinds of foods he eats, the preferred fruits that occupy maybe two-thirds of the diet, are in the bottom left. And these are not like apples and oranges and bananas. These are not nice and soft and sweet, tender. These are very fibrous. They're rather dry. They often taste really nasty. In fact, they're just pretty disgusting. And it's really, really difficult to find any fruit in the wild, in chimpanzee land, with which you would want to fill your stomach. Some of them are really awful. I mean, look at the one top right. They're eating wood. Just putting their jaws on a tree and just chewing the wood. They've actually made a cave into the tree there. And another one, bottom right, is scraping gum off a tree. Now, this is not the way that we think of humans as behaving, of course. A few years later, my wife and I spent 9 months living in northeastern Congo studying pygmies. And the pygmies live in the forest, and they hunt meat, and they exchange meat for vegetable foods from the local farmers. And I wanted to know, if they really had to, what would they eat in that forest? Now, that forest had chimpanzees in it. We heard them on a regular basis, and never saw them. And So I knew the foods that the chimpanzees ate there, and I asked them if they would ever eat these, and they said even in extremis they wouldn't do it. Even when the rebels had come through a few years before, they did not resort to eating the chimpanzee foods. What did they eat? Well, duh, you know, I finally got it. Mostly, they were eating anything that they could cook. So I started thinking about what the significance of cooking is for humans, and although there are repeated stories of the people who live over the hill and eat raw food, actually, it turns out that everybody, everywhere, eats most of their food cooked. It's a human universal. Here we see among a selection of hunters and gatherers, people who are particularly important in our thinking about our evolution, and how much of their meat and fish were cooked. And the answer is the great majority in every case, or literally all of it. And I think one of the fascinating things is not just that cooking is a human universal, but that the evening meal is a universal. And if you think about the way that cooking and eating a raw food work out, it turns out that mostly eating raw is something that people living as hunters and gatherers do as snacks. When they're out on the hunt, when they're out gathering, then they'll pick a few fruits off the bush, or they'll find a mangrove worm or whatever it is and eat them raw. But when they bring them back in the evening, then there's a cooked meal. And as we'll see, I think this turns out to be highly significant for our societies. Well, then I started thinking, well, is it possible that the reason that I, as a chimpanzee observer, did not like the chimpanzee foods very much is because I just become soft. I'm a Westerner. I've got used to all the pleasantries of contemporary food. If I really had to, could I survive on raw food? If explorers really had to, do they survive on raw food? And I searched and searched, and I found minimal cases of people surviving on raw food in the wild. The longest case I found of literally surviving on raw food in the wild, wild food, was 36 days. Since then, I found a case that's a little bit longer. I'm not even sure how long, 60 days maybe. But considering that you can survive just on water for about a month, as a guy did in France recently when he wandered into some mushroom caves, then that's not really very good testimony for the value of raw food. Here I'm noting Alexander Selkirk, who famously lived for 4 years in an island in the South Pacific on his own, and during that time he cooked throughout his existence, and so do all of the people that you can think of who have done sort of weird things in the wild. Thor Heyerdahl, when he went on the Kon-Tiki expedition across the Pacific, he took a cook with him. The cannibals, the marine cannibals, who would be in the Pacific having sailed there from Nantucket and were put to sea and survived for a bit, they cooked the cannibal meat. The Japanese holdouts after the Second World War, who lived for years in the forests of Southeast Asia, they had a little cooking down in their tunnels. And I have yet to find anybody who has survived for any serious length of time on raw wild food. Now, this is all very odd because until really our research group started really questioning the norm, people have assumed that cooking is just a luxury. And one piece of evidence is this, that when the great social anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss, who celebrated his 100th birthday a few months ago, wrote his famous book, The Raw and the Cooked, in the 1960s. One of the things he said was that cooking is fantastically important, but it's only important psychologically. He says, not important from a point of view of biology. So his friend Edmund Leach said, people do not have to cook their food. They do so for symbolic reasons to show that they are men and not beasts. And the point is, nobody challenged that aspect of his analysis. Nobody said, now, wait a minute. Cooking actually means something biologically. And then this notion that cooking is not something important biologically, but is just a kind of pleasant luxury that makes our lives nicer, is sort of reinforced by the classic opinion that it was invented as a cultural thing relatively recently during a period when humanity already existed. And Darwin, who was a great naturalist and understood fully the importance of cooking from the point of view of making food better, as in the first half of this quote, he still said, this discovery of fire, probably the greatest ever made by man. He was thinking that this was something that was made by humans, and therefore the implication is that before it was made, well, humans could live on raw food just fine. And that's the way we've always thought. And because of my trying to make a living while I eat my food while watching chimpanzees, I've now come to the conclusion, as I've followed up the consequences of thinking about cooking, that actually this is all wrong, and that cooking has been responsible for many aspects of our biology and lives and psychology, because it was not something that was invented by people. It was invented by the people, by people's ancestors, by pre-human ancestors. So here's the basic story. The traditional wisdom is that when fire was first controlled, it was controlled to give us various advantages. Mostly people don't even think about cooking. I can say this because I've actually done a review of the textbooks in anthropology, and the average space devoted to cooking from an evolutionary perspective is about a paragraph in books lasting 300 pages. It's just not there at all. If you're thinking about fire, well, okay, heat, light, protection against predators, and so on. This is viewed as a nice addition to make life a little bit more comfortable, and it has no evolutionary role at all. That's what you'll see in the textbooks nowadays. And I now think that actually the key benefit of the control of fire is the fact that we can cook our food. And the reason for this is that it gives us energy. And as a source of energy, it changes our biology dramatically. For this reason, I want to talk about energy first. And I think part of the reason why cooking has not been regarded as at all important for thinking about who we are, where we come from, what we are doing on this earth, is because there hasn't been a theory of cooking, a theory of what cooking does. And probably you've thought about this and you've come to your own conclusion, and you might well have thought that energy is important already. But the fact is, you won't see it in the textbooks, you won't see it in works on nutrition and so on. So I want, first of all, just lay out the notion that cooking gives us energy, and then just touch on a couple of aspects that I develop in this book, Catching Fire. One is that cooking is old, goes right back to the beginning of human existence, and second, that it's got terrific impact on our family structure. Well, this energy question. This is a picture of Angela. You can find lots and lots of pictures like this on the web, people posting them up. She is showing herself both after eating cooked food and after eating raw food. And people note that when they eat raw food, then they tend to lose weight. Now, this is raw food in a sort of fairly informal sense, because if we define cooking as processing food with the aid of heat, actually most urban raw foodists, which is what raw foodists are, people who live in towns and are able to visit supermarkets, they actually do cook their food a little bit. They cook it up to about 114 degrees Fahrenheit, because the traditional wisdom for many raw foodists is that what you want to do is to keep the food sufficiently cool that the enzymes in the food are not killed. And that is supposed to be at about 114 degrees Fahrenheit. Well, the belief is not accepted by most physiologists, but it does lead to the ability to eat food that has been slightly cooked. And in addition, it has been sprouted, pressed, ground, liquidized, blended, in other words, prepared in many, many ways. They are also eating food of relatively high quality. It's because most of this is domesticated food, which is much better than the wild foods. Now, you know, Angela's experience is informal, of course. What do we have of the science of what happens to people who eat raw foods? Well, here is a very rare example of a sort of experiment, but it's a flawed experiment from a scientific perspective because the people involved are a very restricted group, hypertension patients. But in fact, it is recorded that if you give them more raw food in their diet, then they lose weight. They become increasingly thin over at least a six-month period. But we don't have data from experiments, so we have to look at surveys. And here is a survey. Here's the all of the survey data that I know of that are available, looking at the body mass index on the left-hand axis, which is the weight divided by the height squared. And you see that people who are eating cooked diets have higher body mass index than people who are eating raw diets, and this is true whether or not you take into account the meat eating. So there's very little impact of meat eating on the body mass index of those who are eating cooked diets. And even raw foodists quite often eat meat, include some meat in their diet, and in the BEST study from Germany, they were able to look at how much the contribution of meat influenced the body mass index, and it didn't influence it at all. So people who eat raw food tend to be thin. But much more important is this. In that BEST study of German raw foodists, what was found was that as women increased the proportion of raw food in their diets up to 100%, 50% of them became completely amenorrheic. They were not menstruating, and a further 20% or so had subfecund cycles. So here you have, under the very best conditions of being able to get the highest quality of food from supermarkets all year, people taking relatively little exercise compared to those hunting and gathering, still unable to biologically function on average from the point of view of reproduction. And this, as I say, when they're eating high-quality diets compared to the things that chimpanzees are eating, and, of course, in the case of chimpanzees, totally flourishing on. I mean, they eat what for us is almost inedible, and they have babies at high rates. So there's something different about humans. The ordinary thought is animals eat their food raw. We are animals. Therefore, we can eat our food raw. But it's wrong, because we are different kinds of animals. We have evolved. Now, one of the peculiar things about this is that as you look into it, you find that the available information from the nutritional sciences does not help a great deal. And this is illustrated here, because after I was discovering that all of the evidence pointed to raw diets offering us very many fewer calories than cooked diets, I thought, well, let's go and find out what the nutritional scientists say. So I wanted to look up in the standard compilations of data on nutrient composition. And the USDA has thousands of food items on its website, which is the source from which all of the food labels are derived on the sides of the cornflake packets and so on. And in some cases, the same lab has taken a particular food type and analyzed the calorie content cooked and the calorie content raw. So then you can say, okay, well, let's find out. If you take a piece of beef and you cook it, then does it increase the calorie content? Well, what this graph shows is the answer is no, because what it shows is that the energy density when cooked is, according to the standard compilations, exactly the same as the energy density when raw. Now, this, I think, is simply wrong. And what it reflects is the fact that we do not have a system for recording the calorie density in our foods that is sensitive to the processing. I think what it means is that if you had a friend who ate raw food and decided that on the basis of these tables, these official tables, what would constitute a 2,000-calorie diet, and they then died from starvation, as they probably would, then you would be perfectly justified in suing the USDA. Because the USDA, like the British equivalent, the Institute of Food Chemistry, they use, as everybody does throughout the world, the Atwater Convention to understand what is the calorie density in food. And here's the way it works. Wilbur Olin Atwater developed a fine type of bomb calorimeter at the turn of the last century, 1890s, 1900s. And he said, okay, we can find out how much carbohydrate, how much fat, how much protein there is in a food, and you can blow these things up, and that will tell you how much energy is released when they're ignited. And we'll say, okay, 10% of it is not used for various reasons, and the rest of it is used by the human body. And it doesn't matter whether you cook it or leave it raw, because either way, the amount of energy when you blow it up is the same. But in the human digestive system, we do not blow up our food. We add enzymes. We add acid. We slowly churn and mash in our intestines. And the less that a food is processed, then the harder our bodies have to work to do it. And the less that a food is processed, the less of the food actually gets digested at all. And that's why, contrary to our official food labels, raw food is worth less than cooked food. So let me give you a couple of examples, trying to escape the Atwater food processing fallacy, which I think is important because it's the kind of information which contributes to this problem of understanding why cooking is so important. So how well is raw food digested? Now, some people say, oh, well, you know, we know that raw food can be digested very well because you can look at the amount of protein, say, in a food that you ingest, and then you can look at the amount of that protein in the feces, and you can find it's all gone, and so you digested it. And that's been, you know, an argument that was used actually 10 years ago when I produced the first paper about this, and people said, no, you know, raw food's just as good as cooked food because of that. Well, but guess what? When you look at an animal like me, there are actually sort of two things you're looking at from the point of view of food. One is the thing you can see, and the other is the microflora that live in my large intestine, somewhere around here. And those microflora in the large intestine are consumers of food, and any protein, for instance, that gets into the large intestine and is consumed by the microflora produces no caloric value for us, for me, the thing you can see, at all. So it's no good saying what's the difference between what we eat and what we excrete. What you have to say is what's the difference between what we eat and what goes into the large intestine, which is at the end of the small intestine. So here we are at the end of the small intestine. That's when digestion stops and food goes into the large intestine. What we need to know is what's the difference between the amount of food that is digested when it's raw versus when it's cooked by the end of the small intestine? Well, there's not that much data on this, amazingly. This, I think, is all the data there is on starch, and it's more information you want to see, but let me just illustrate. If we take in vivo studies of people who have eaten raw green bananas, these are the things that people cook all over the world as equivalent of potatoes, or cooked, you see the data here. Now, these data are obtained in interesting way of using patients who have an ileostomy. An ileostomy is a little bag that is put onto the end of the small intestine for patients who have lost their large intestine for some kind of disease reason and therefore do not have a properly functioning gut. But the way that they are able to live, some of you may have relatives like this, I have one, is that the food is allowed to, as it were, be excreted into this little bag at the end of the small intestine, which lies on the surface of the abdomen. And if you're a researcher, you can come along every 15 minutes and say, okay, what's come out of the end of the small intestine? Well, that's what's happened here. and they can actually look at the starch granules and count them and see how many are coming through. Well, if the food has been cooked, then they're almost all gone. It's been 99% digestible. But if the food is raw, in the case of the green banana, only 47% digestible. This is massive. There's a huge difference. Here's the overall effect. Massive increases in digestibility as a result of cooking. And we know enough about starch chemistry to understand why this happens. I won't be able to talk about it now. But what about meat? Meat science is a huge industry. Meat science, there are journals of meat science, textbooks of meat science. The aim of meat science is to produce food that is palatable and enjoyable by the consumer. And yet I was astonished after trying to penetrate this literature for months on end to finally write to one of the authors of a key textbook, Paul Warris, saying, okay, you know, what do we know about the effect of cooking on the digestibility of meat proteins? And here's what he said. The effects of cooking on the energy value of meat do not seem to have been a topic of interest to meat scientists. Now, it's true that it's very difficult to organize an equivalent of the test that I've just shown you with starch granules for meat. But someone has done an ingenious system with eggs. Now, this is a really interesting area because egg protein ought, you might think, to be incredibly digestible when it is raw. I mean, it's been adapted for chicks to just take maximum advantage of as they grow, of course. That's what it's doing in the egg. And we know that it's very high-quality protein. It's got a very high biological value in the sense that rats grow very well on it, better than on any other protein. And we know that even when it's cooked and been made solid, so you might think it's harder to digest, it is highly digestible. Furthermore, for those of you who are fans of the Rocky series, Rocky Balboa and the original Rocky, you know, you may remember that bodybuilders really swear by raw eggs, and Vince Gironda, who was Arnie Schwarzenegger's mentor, he was the one who recommended eating 36 raw eggs a day, because this is, you know, nature's great food, okay? Now, in the case of eggs, what people were able to do was this. They fed chickens on food that had stable isotopes, that was labeled with stable isotopes. And then those chickens laid eggs that have got stable isotopes in them. And then they were able to feed those eggs to people under supervised conditions and take ileostomy patients and then see how much of the labeled protein was coming out as protein as opposed to later as amino acids that had been digested. And here's the answer. They found with a small sample of ileostomy patients that egg protein was far better digested when it was cooked than when it was raw. 91-94% when cooked and 51-65% when raw. Somebody who invents a system of agriculture that produces 2% more milk from their cows is a millionaire. We're talking about animals, once they starting to cook their food, getting 30% more out of their food. This is huge from the point of view of evolution. It means they're going to survive better and have more babies. And we don't know what the total effect is. But let me just emphasize that this is a measure of the actual amount of food you're getting out of it. Because once the protein goes into the large intestine, it produces no merit at all. In the case of starch, 50% of the value is probably returned to you after it goes into the large intestine. In the case of protein, zero. Why? What's responsible for this? It's pretty clear. The scientists who did this work considered that denaturation is the key. Denaturation is the opening up of a protein's three-dimensional structure from being the equivalent of a tightly wound, knitted ball of wool to opening up and the strands being available to then be snipped by the digestive enzymes. Heat predictably denatures proteins and exposes them to the action of digestive enzymes. So I've just been taking you through one aspect of why cooking is very valuable in terms of energy. It increases the proportion of the nutrients that are actually accessible to our bodies to digest. Now let me take you to another one. And this is that when we digest our food, it costs work. It can actually cost a lot of work. For some foods, it may be 20, 30% of the value of the food is spent in digesting it. And if you can reduce that cost of digestion, then you're going to get extra value in your energy. Okay, so here is a wonderful experiment with rats that indicates the effect of cooking, because cooking softens every kind of food that we cook. Well, you can cook meat in a way that makes it tougher, but the aim of cooking is to make it softer. In this particular experiment, the experimenters were able to isolate softness as a particular variable. So what they did was they took the regular laboratory chow that some rats were eating, they broke it back into its component pieces, and then put it together again exactly as before, but they did it in two ways. One was exactly as before, and the other one was they added air. So essentially what they did was they puffed it up. They took the equivalent of a grain of wheat and puffed it up to make puffed wheat. Each of these little pellets had exactly the same number of calories as before. They had the same weight as before. They had the same water content as before, and so on. They then fed these to two groups of rats, and they monitored how much they ate, and the answer was they ate the same amount, and they monitored how much locomotion they expended, and they used the same energy in locomotion. So they'd had the same calories in, and they'd used the same number of calories in their energy for locomotion. And what happened? The ones eating the softer diet grew faster. You can see here that by the time they get to the age of 22 weeks, even before they're adult, they're significantly bigger. And the ones on the softer diet, eating the same number of calories, expending the same number of amount of calories in locomotion, had 30% more body fat. Where did this difference come from? It came in the cost of digestion. Here is what happens when you have a meal. You know what happens when you have a big meal. You want to go to sleep. That's because oxygen is being diverted to your gut, because your gut is working harder, and it's less available for your brain and your peripheral tissues. Well, the same thing happens with every animal. Here you see the increase in metabolism following a meal, but the increase is greater for the rats eating the harder diet. Every time they eat a softer diet, they're saving a bit of energy. And in the end, it mounts up, and they get more for their meal. And they're over time, they're acquiring more fat, they're saving more energy. So I think this is very significant because, you know, you think about the way that food processing over the last decades, over the last century, has made food more digestible, the same food. You know, the same loaf of bread now has the same number of calories, if you like, according to the food labeling system, but is processed more finely than the breads of 100 years ago. So for what apparently is the same number of calories, we are getting more net energy gain. I think this is a potentially significant contributor to the obesity crisis. And we've tested this once in an animal with meat. And the model animal is the Burmese python, which is the subject of lots of metabolic studies. And we were able to give pythons meat that we had ground and that we had cooked, or that we'd ground and cooked. And you see the results here. The reduction in the cost of digestion was 12% when you grind the meat, just steak tartare, and another 12% when you cook it. And the results are essentially independent. It's 23% when you grind and you cook it. So that's probably why all over the world, hunters and gatherers do this sort of thing. They never eat their flesh raw. When meat is so tender that the sinews will fall apart, then you crush it in a mortar. It's like hamburgers. You mince it up and you cook it. You're saving yourself the cost of digestion. So that's the bare bones of the energy hypothesis of cooking. And I got into it in a little bit of detail just to give you a sort of real sense of conviction that this is actually important. And until you realize that cooking is doing this very important thing, you don't realize just how significant it is from a biological perspective. I also think that it enables us to get into the question of cooking being old, or, you know, how old cooking is. Because the fact that humans are adapted to a diet of cooked food meaning that we really fare very poorly on diets of raw food, has to be explained in biological terms. And the explanation looks pretty darn simple. You look at this photograph of Fifi and Jane Goodall, and you might say, well, you know, the big sort of striking thing is that one is hairier than the other, or that one's got a smaller brain than the other. But to me, the really striking thing is that one's got a tiny little mouth. Humans, I mean, if you're used to seeing chimps and gorillas and orangutans and so on, humans just look absurd, this sort of tiny little opening we've got, because our food is so soft and easily chewed. And that's one of the pieces of evidence that suggests to me that cooking goes right back to the origins of the earliest full member of the genus Homo. So in this schematic, what you see is 2 million years of human evolution, with the four main species represented, beginning with Homo erectus, starting around 1.9 million years ago. And what I want to draw your attention to is that whether they're talking about sapiens or Neanderthals or Heidelbergensis or erectus, they all look pretty darn human. Some people even think that erectus ought to be called sapiens and call all of these things Homo sapiens, just variants on that theme. Because all of them could walk into a store on Main Street and pick something off the shelf and wear it. But that's not true for earlier ancestors. Now, obviously, the control of fire is central to understanding when we first cooked, and we'd like to be able to use the archaeological evidence to say, well, when exactly did we first start controlling fire? And the answer is that the archaeological evidence doesn't tell us. It decays in a sort of fairly steady, rather rapid rate. There is no threshold at which we suddenly have evidence of the control of fire and at which we don't. Right back to 1.6 million years ago, you see traces of evidence for the control of fire, and it gets murky. So we can't use that. But what we can use is the difference between humans in our biology and our pre-human ancestors. Here are the familiar Australopithecines that have been around for almost 7 million years and finally died out altogether 1 million years ago. And it was these, around 2.5 million years ago, that launched the move towards human evolution. These are things that had big teeth, big mouths, and, to judge from the shape of their ribs, big guts. Here you see their teeth in Australopithecus afarensis there in the middle, and then the immediate pre-human ancestor, Australopithecus or Homo habilis, and then a great drop in tooth size to Homo erectus, the biggest drop in tooth size in the story of human evolution. Very difficult to explain if they were just eating meat, where you need a different kind of tooth altogether. But for something eating soft food, it makes sense. And here you see evidence for the size of the gut, a reduction in the flaring of the ribs, a reduction in the breadth of the pelvis, indicating that with Homo erectus, for the first time, you have a small gut, just like ourselves. So those are the pieces of evidence that suggest that the time when cooking began was the time when we committed ourselves to a diet of soft food through our smaller mouths and smaller guts, and that was 1.8, 1.9 million years ago with the evolution of Homo erectus. And incidentally, at the same time, Homo erectus was the first species that committed itself to being mostly on the ground, because they were lousy climbers. Their shoulders, their arms, even their ears show that they were not well adapted for climbing. And it's hard for me to imagine how they could have been comfortable sleeping on the ground, as they therefore must, unless they had controlled fire. How easy would it have been to go from controlling fire for whatever reason, such as protecting yourself against predators, to eating food, learning that by putting food into the fire, it would improve it? I think very easy indeed. Chimpanzees do sometimes take advantage of fire. There's this tree, Abzelia, whose seeds you see here in West Africa, and they never eat the seeds of Abzelia raw. But after they've fallen, and then when a bushfire goes through, they will make directed journeys to Abzelia trees and look for the seeds that have been cooked. They figured that bit much out. And we've tested all the great apes and found that none of them prefer their food raw. there are some foods that they don't mind whether it's raw or cooked, and others in which they prefer it cooked, such as beef and a couple of veg here. There's all sorts of evidence now that in our tongues there are special systems of innervation that make us sensitive to the physical characteristics of food in such a way that we end up preferring those foods that are actually easier to digest, softer foods. So, to cut a long story short, the cooking hypothesis suggests that the signs of commitment to a cooked diet that we see in our small mouths and small guts take us back to an origin of cooking around 1.9 million years ago with the habilines. Thank you very much. And then, incidentally, for those of you who are sort of specialists in thinking about anthropology, I think you've got an earlier phase when meat eating was tremendously important from roughly 2.5 million years onwards. And during that phase, there wouldn't have been any cooking, but there would have been some pounding of the meat, which was maybe in some ways leading us in the direction of cooking. We can talk about that in question time, maybe. Well, I'm moving fast because time is short. Let me just very quickly note something about cooking and society. Many people have suggested that cooking is really very intimately related to our social relationships. Michael Simons has this rather wonderful way of putting it. He says, cooking is the starting place of all trades, and he says, poetically, sources dispense goodness. A lot of people writing about cooking see it as very fundamental to the sharing, to the companionship that we feel around the campfire or at the table. But it's not obvious why this should be. I mean, cooking might have something to do with starting meals, but we saw that Alexander Selkirk lived for years on his own. You don't have to have anyone else there to be able to cook a meal. And many people just think of cooking really as a larger, as a part of the larger issue of the sexual division of labor. Women do, in every traditional society, cook meals for their husbands. The urban industrial society is really the only one in which you often get men cooking for their wives. And maybe this is part of the sexual division of labor, and the sexual division of labor is normally thought of as she brings in one kind of food, he brings in another kind of food, and they have meat and veg for dinner. But although people have developed theories that say this is the fundamental source of the complementarity of the human household, actually, you find that there are various societies in which this just does not happen. I mean, among the Inuit, women produce no food at all because all of the things that they eat are things that men hunt. And among the Tiwi of Northern Australia, men produce extremely little, vanishingly little, so little that they say that without a wife I would starve. So that pushes me in the direction of thinking that cooking has become really important for human households, and I actually developed the idea that it generates the sexual division of labor. The cooking is fundamental to it. And here's a couple of reasons. The first is cooking actually enables evening meals. Now, why is this? Well, it's because cooking makes your food softer, and because it's softer, it means you can eat it very fast. That means that a man can go out all day and just snack and be basically very hungry, but then come back and eat many calories, maybe 2,000 calories, in an hour in the evening. Humans, on average, spend less than an hour a day chewing their food. But if we were great apes, we would be spending about half the day chewing our food, because that's what great apes do, to the great disappointment of filmers who go out and want to see them doing interesting things. All they do is sit there just chewing most of the time. And when they're not chewing most of the time, what they're doing is resting between meals while their stomach is emptying. Now, if we were doing that, it's very difficult to imagine how the sexual division of labor could happen, because one sex can't go off and do one thing and one do the other, and then they come back and have their evening meal because they'd be chewing and resting until 3 a.m. They have to spend their day just collecting the food and chewing it on site in order to be able to satisfy those sorts of demands. So it's only once you have a way of having a greatly reduced chewing time that it is possible to have the complementarity that humans show. And then here's another problem with cooking. Cooking imposes on the cooks a vulnerability to social competition. And that is because you bring back your food, you unsling your carross, you put it down by your fire, and now you absolutely have to wait until the food gets ready. And during the time that you're waiting, someone else might come along, someone who's lazy or hungry or who's had bad luck on the hunt that day, and say, "I'd like some of that, please." And you might say, "Well, sorry, you know, it's for my friends and relations," and then there might be a fight. And if it was animals, there definitely would be a fight. But humans never fight about this stuff. They are incredibly gracious. There is a phenomenally well-organized system of social rules that mean that in hunter-gatherer society, people are very, very restrained and very respectful of the food that individuals bring in. Well, to me, this signals something very important, a real step away from animal life and the development of very specific social rules designed to deal with this very particular problem. I think cooking is probably the first thing that really brings ownership and therefore the necessity for these social rules. And there are two big social rules that social anthropologists have drawn attention to. One is that wives absolutely must feed their husbands every night. And this is great from the point of view of men because they are able to guarantee whatever they've done during the day that they're going to get an evening meal that night. Now, this is great, of course, for married men. For unmarried men, it's not so good. And unmarried men have a real problem. Bachelors are the hungry, sorry creatures in hunter-gatherer society. And the second rule is that a wife is absolutely not allowed to feed another man in particular, but anyone in general, other than her husband and close kin, unless the husband has actually invited them to do so. But you, as just a hungry bachelor, cannot go up to a woman in one of these traditional societies and say, "Excuse me, I'm really hungry, you know, can you feed me?" This would be against all of the social conventions. And in fact, if a woman feeds a man that her husband has not approved of, she's essentially saying in that action, "I'm divorcing my husband and I'm marrying you." This is so serious that anthropologists have to be warned about this when they visit a new society. And if they're naive about these rules, they can get into a very embarrassing situation. You do not accept food from a woman. Well, these are rules that work very well, and I'm just sort of signaling the argument produced in this book. But basically what I think is going on is that because cooking enables the sexual division of labor through softening the food and reducing enormously the amount of time it takes to eat food, and because of this threat of social competition over the food, I think sexual division of labor is ultimately derived from cooking, and the fundamental nature of the sexual division of labor is this primitive protection racket. It's the wife cooks for the husband, which is a great deal for him, and what the wife gets out of it is a conduit to the social community and their protection of her food supply. So that if a bachelor or some lousy group of teenage boys or the woman that she just can't stand start taking her food from her, she can complain to her husband, and then the husband and the other men will do something about it. And this leads to all sorts of sort of fascinating aspects of society, which I won't go through now because let's take a couple of questions. But let me just note the bottom one here. Sexual promiscuity, which we think of as the most important sort of dynamic in marriage, is actually common in many of these small-scale hunter-gatherer societies, and clearly less important than food promiscuity. Food promiscuity means the woman feeds another man. That's just out of the question. And actually, even if you think about modern society today, there will be relationships in which you can imagine in which if you find that your mate has been feeding somebody else, in some ways it's a little bit more threatening than if they just had sex with someone else. It's particularly threatening in those societies. It is so important, this arrangement, that for bachelors, they very often end up marrying women who are significantly older than themselves. They will, in the Tiwi society, 80% of a man's first marriages are to a woman older than himself, many of them postmenopausal, because it gets them to the status of a married man where they can do manly things, and their sexual strategy, their mating strategy, is partly independent of who you're married to. But who you're married to, that gives you food. So what I've been arguing is that we are biologically adapted to cooking. Cooking is something that's universal. We absolutely need it. Our guts are shaped to it. Our bodies are not well adapted to eating meat, and there's been oodles of time for us to become biologically adapted. You can get a new species in 5,000 years. We absolutely know that fire has been around for 250,000 years, the control of fire, and I'm arguing that it's been around for longer than that, 2 million years. We're biologically adapted to eating cooked food, and just like other species that are biologically adapted to their food, it affects so many different things. Cows are adapted to eating grass. Fleas are adapted to eating blood. We are adapted to eating cooked food. So we need to answer why we need it. It should affect our origins, and it affects many aspects of our society and our cognition. So that's my story. I think that if you want to understand who we are, a major component has been that compared to the other apes to which we're so closely related and yet from which we're so different, we should think of ourselves as adapted to cooked food. We're the cooking apes, creatures of the flame. So thank you very much. And now we have 35 questions to answer in 3 minutes. Now. So I have no idea how to take these in order because it seems unfair that the bottom ones are the ones that were asked first. So let me take a couple of questions from the bottom pile. What, in your opinion, is the healthiest diet, i.e. 50% meat, 50% vegetarian, or ... Whew. One of the things that, I constantly come across in my research over the last 10 years, all sorts of areas where there are very strong opinions based on too little data. And I don't want to fall into that fallacy. What I would say is that your best diet depends a lot on who you are. I've pointed out that I think that raw diets are not something to which we are adapted. I do think that raw diets can often be extremely healthy, and some people find the products of cooking to be very difficult for them. They find them to be essentially allergens. The Maillard compounds that are produced from the combination of amino acids and sugars under heat are things that are carcinogenic in some species and appear to be causes of inflammation in some individuals. So it's going to depend on who you are. But the question was about 50% meat, 50% vegetarian. Well, again, it depends on what state you're in. If you're a hunter-gatherer, then that's probably a terrific balance, and it's about what you have in the tropics. But here, meat is a factor that predisposes for cardiovascular disease, and the meat is very fatty, and most of us have more calories coming in than we need, in which case I would suggest that you want to have probably more on the vegetarian side and maybe more on the raw side. So it all depends who you are. Is that a way of weaseling out of that question or what? Okay. What is the difference between cooking by microwave versus over a fire in digestible nutrients? Whew. Well, I guess I don't know enough about the differences exactly, but what this reminds me of is the fact that among the experts who have pronounced about the impact or the importance or unimportance of cooking, some of them have said cooking leads to, in the case of meat, loss of nutrients through dripping, so drip losses, and loss of nutrients through this Maillard process, the combination of amino acids and sugars that particularly happens at the surface of the meat, and it leads to a huge variety of compounds, many of which are thought to be toxic, and some of which, all of which, I think, are considered to be indigestible, to not contribute any energy. So for that reason, many people have said cooking by a fire leads to a loss of nutrient gain. And you will see that in various textbooks. Now, you know, my perspective on that is that people have thrown out the baby with the bathwater. You know, they've fixed on a couple of little influences and not noticed that meanwhile, even though you're getting some drip losses, even though you're getting some Maillard compounds, nevertheless, the body of the meat is all becoming denatured and more digestible, and there's a loss of there's a reduction in the cost of digestion and so on. So I'm going to use that question as a way of just reminding us that it's amazing how difficult it is to see the big picture. It's very easy to focus on one or two little consequences of cooking, whether it's by microwave or by roasting, and say, this is the consequence that's important. And I think it's not until you see the overall effect, such as through the impact of a raw diet on body weight, that you can really make a judgment about what's the best type. Time for one more question. Yes. Okay. What is the... I shouldn't have asked this one. Here it is. What is the most significant and convincing argument against your hypothesis, and what is your response? Maybe I should ask someone from the audience to ask, what is the most significant and convincing argument against it? You know, I mean, I don't want to sound too sort of dismissive, or I genuinely don't feel it, but I would point out that I'm finding in question times quite often people are saying, it's so obvious what you're saying. You know, how come people haven't talked about this before? And one of the reviews said that. And I actually find that is a commoner response than anyone strongly objecting. I think it's just really weird that we haven't paid more attention to the notion that cooking could have been important in our biology. But still, that's a really weaselly response to this. What is the most significant and convincing argument against your hypothesis? Well, I think that the principal objection that I hear is from archaeologists who say we really need to see the smoking barbecue pit. That until the archaeological evidence is brought in line with the biological argument, then it's still an open question. That's kind of frustrating because that could take an awfully long time. I mean, you got a hint from one of my diagrams of the decay of the archaeological evidence, and so it suggests that we're going to have 100 times more sites before a few of them get to the point where we can see convincing evidence in the very early stages. Ultimately, I think the genetic evidence may become very important as well, because we should see genetic evidence associated with particular aspects adapted to cooking in our bodies, such as maybe resistance to the deleterious effects of Maillard compounds. So that's a favorite little idea of mine, that if we've been exposed to Maillard compounds for 2 million years, then we should see selection to make them relatively benign in our case. Anyway, I think it's the lack of archaeology that people find most difficult to take. Let's see, I'm going to dodge that one for the moment. So why are most chefs male? I think that probably says. And to me, the answer to that is that a chef is a professional. And they're the equivalent of the hunter in the hunter-gatherer system. I'm not suggesting that there's something deeply biological that means that a woman is sort of driven to cook from some inner urge. I think it develops out of these social dynamics. And why is a male, why are most chefs male? It's because those are jobs that are getting paid, and that's just sort of part of larger society. And as I understand it, a lot of households in which chefs are male have meals at home that are cooked by the women. Anyone got any comments on that one? No? That just tells me to end in 3 minutes, so that's fine. If humans have had meat diets over time, how did the vegetarian movement gain status and credibility? Well, I mean, you have to have a sociologist to answer that one. You know, there are all these wonderful beliefs associated with vegetarianism, some of which I agree with, actually. A common one is that vegetarianism is associated with, left-wing politics. But you know, this is part of a larger question of where our strange diets come from. And for me, it's a strange notion that the raw diet is natural. So if the raw diet is actually not natural, why do so many people think it is? Well, for me, it's because it actually can be very good for people to have a raw diet, and they want to have a justification for it that will help them overcome what is actually an extremely difficult thing to do, because you get very, very hungry on a raw food diet, and it takes a lot of will to be able to stick to it. If a raw diet is not a reasonable diet, what about the vegan diet? Or is the important distinction raw versus cooked? I do think the important distinction is raw versus cooked. Vegan diets, I don't know a huge amount about it, but as I understand it, vegan diets are dangerous for children, whether they're raw or cooked, because of the losses of certain vitamins. And so I think that, like most of these diets, they're probably fine for adults, but you've got to be very, very careful about the micronutrient aspect when you're dealing with children. And is it possible to design a long-term experiment which teaches a primitive primate to control fire and ultimately to cook? Well, it's a wonderful concept, and there are chimpanzees, bonobos, and orangutans who have all been seen tending fires in various different circumstances. I think it would not be out of the question at all to generate cooking on a fairly regular basis by great apes. And, you know, we know they like cooked food. You know, we know that the bonobo Kanzi, when instructed by his teacher and friend, Sue Savage Rumba, would go off into the woods and collect sticks and put them in a pile and light a fire and take a skillet and fry sausages on it. It's a skill that is very close to the surface for great apes. Whether or not they would maintain the cooking, I don't know, because they do have that problem of having to control the fighting over the food. And I think one of the wonderful messages about cooking in humans is that it is associated with some of our most delightful social and emotional characteristics, our wonderful ability to share and share companionship around the hearth. So let me leave it there.
Thank you, Dr. Wrangham. And now this program of the Commonwealth Club is coming to an end.